Welcome to Clinical Conversations. It's a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending June 25th. This is podcast number 93. I'm Joe Elia. The New England Journal of Medicine has a couple of interesting perspectives this week on radiation overuse and radiation safety. We've got a conversation with the author of the essay entitled, "Is Computed Tomography Safe?" But first, an overview of the week's top clinical news. First this week, California is reporting that it has a bad pertussis epidemic underway, its worst in 50 years. There have been close to 1,000 cases diagnosed so far, with 5 infant deaths. It's hard to imagine that the organism will respect state lines, and the advice for parents and caregivers to get vaccinated before bringing new babies home is worth considering elsewhere. And speaking of babies, there's a report from the UK that women who spend their pregnancies close to cell phone towers are no more likely than others to have their children suffer childhood cancers. In other news, homocysteine lowering, again, is not effective as secondary prevention against cardiovascular events after a myocardial infarction, according to a large JAMA study conducted among 12,000 MI survivors randomized to either homocysteine-lowering supplements or placebos for 7 years. Long sentence, but you get the point. Finally this week, the FDA has approved a new blood test that detects HIV antigen as well as antibody. Since the antibodies don't form for days after exposure, being able to detect antigen could allow treatment to start earlier. That's it for the news. Let's get on to our conversation. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. The New England Journal of Medicine has released online a perspective essay which asks the direct question, is computed tomography safe? The author, Professor Rebecca Smith-Bindman, has agreed to share her thoughts with us. She's currently finishing up a stint as visiting research scientist in the Radiation Epidemiology Branch of the National Cancer Institute. She holds a professorship at the University of California, San Francisco, where she has appointments in the departments of radiology and biomedical imaging, epidemiology and biostatistics, and obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences. Welcome, Dr. Smith-Bindman.
Thank you so much.
I want to ask you right away the question that you pose in the title of your essay. Is computed tomography safe?
The answer is that yes. Computer tomography is safe, but it's not as safe as it can be. So I think it's a fabulous test. I think it's usually conducted very well, but I think there are things that we can do to make it safer. And given how important CT is to clinical care, I think it's imperative that we do that. And that's for two reasons. First, when errors are made in the dosing, there's the possibility that the radiation doses can be very high, and that's that can lead to radiation poisoning. But even more important, even when done correctly, it's associated with cancer because it delivers radiation. So it's really important to keep those doses as low as possible and to really only use CT imaging when we think it's indicated and is going to really change the management of our patients.
You mentioned a total of 75 million CT scans conducted. Was that, and that's in the U.S., was that over the course of a single year?
Each year, 75 million scans are done, at least currently. Over time, that has increased. So if you go back, let's say, 15 years, the number that are done today is threefold higher than 15 years ago. But currently, 75 million scans are done each year. That it turns out they're not equally spread out over the entire U.S. population. So there are a lot more tests done in older patients than younger patients. And among an individual patient who gets a CT, the average number is 2. So, in fact, we do repeat imaging very, very often.
I see. So I was doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and I thought, well, if you say that the U.S. has a population of 300 million, then and you averaged it all out, that would be 20% of the population has a CT scan.
And so the back-of-the-envelope calculations are excellent, but since people, on average, who get them get two, instead of being 20%, it's about 10%.
It's 10%.
And that's the number we... 10% of the population gets a CT scan every year.
And that's what you use in your article, so...
That's great. It's nice when those numbers work out.
So one of your recommendations is to record the dosage of radiation in the patient's record. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, every time you give a patient a drug, you know, the route of administration, the time, the drug, and the person administering that is recorded. That's not done for CT, is it?
It's not done for CT, and I think it's an area where medical imaging needs to catch up to the other areas where we're concerned about medical safety, consistency. So one of the things I really argue for in this perspective is that we need to start standardizing how we're doing the examination. So currently, the same patient sent for the same study to two different institutions will be expected to get a very different dose. And that's, it doesn't really make sense to have it that way. If they're sent for a particular scan type, we should figure out as a community what that should be, and we should have consistency. That information should be recorded in the patient's medical record so that any doctor who needs to order another test knows the patient's history of exposure in the past. I also think the process of recording the dose would raise awareness to these doses. So currently, physicians and technologists are not very informed about what the doses are. Several studies have found that. And so just the very process of writing it down, using metrics that people can understand, putting it in the medical record, comparing those doses to the doses other patients get in similar settings, I think would all raise awareness of the importance of dose. And then it would lead to, I think, facilities trying to compete on dose. You know, we do the same study at a lower dose, and I think that would be a really good thing. So we're definitely a few steps behind, for example, the way drugs are monitored, or if patients have allergies to drugs, that's part of the medical record. And I think we really need to sort of step up and to establish diagnostic reference levels or target doses, and then see how we're doing compared to those reference levels and put this information in the patient's medical record.
And why do you think there's this reluctance or this absence of recording? I mean, is the CT a black box that, as you say, physicians don't really understand the dosages used in CT?
No, I think it's there's several parts to your question. The first part that I think it's really important to acknowledge is that it's not so easy to calculate dose. It varies quite a bit by the kind of machine, what the settings are, and even the patient's size. You need to adjust the way the dose is set up depending on patient characteristics. And I think because it's difficult, we just haven't done it. Part of the difficulty is the data that need to go into these calculations that would allow you to estimate dose have not been readily available consistently across different CT scanners. So several months ago, the Manufacturers Alliance, a group called MIDA, agreed to record the dose information in a consistent fashion for all machines sold by the end of this year. And I think that's a really, really helpful thing that they've done. I think if they have that dose information available on existing scanners, you know, by some software upgrade, that would really facilitate our tracking dose. But it hasn't been that easy to record dose. But I think the fact that it's not easy is not an excuse. I think we still need to do it. We need to approximate dose when we can't calculate it exactly. And this is something that's been done in Canada and the UK and a half dozen European countries for over a decade. And by recording dose comparison to standards, they've successfully lowered the doses the average patient receives.
And you mentioned the manufacturers. There has been a lot of investment in these machines by physicians themselves. And they are allowed the loophole, apparently, of owning and self-referral. This is one of the exceptions that they have under Medicare. Do you think that's been a good policy, or has it encouraged overuse?
So the topic that you're asking about is not specifically about the doses, but rather utilization. Mm-hmm. And I think you're asking if one of the drivers of utilization is, you know, direct financial incentive towards the scan.
That's right.
And it's a very difficult question to answer and quantify, and the reason is that we don't have very clear evidence-based guidelines about when to use imaging. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of those guidelines, lots of factors are driving increased imaging. So one of them is patient-desired imaging. Patients think, you know, modern imaging is fabulous, which it is, and they think it's a reflection of getting good care when they get offered these imaging tests. And when they're not offering them, they may ask for them, even if it doesn't matter. So patient-driven demand is important. Mm-hmm. physician-driven demand is important, meaning that sometimes it's easier to order a test than it is to spend time speaking to a patient. And so maybe just do a scan, learn everything you can, and then think about it later. There's also people who have raised the concerns of malpractice concerns, that they're fearful if they don't order a test, they'll be vulnerable to litigation if something's missed. And then on top of that, you add another reason people get imaging, which is that they financially benefit from the scan if they own part of the scan or have some referral arrangement. I think all of those are important. We don't know how much one is more important than the other. What I can say is very clearly that imaging in every group is going up, and I think the main driver is uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know when these tests are really going to lead to improvements in outcomes, so we just do them all the time. And one of sort of the ironic catch-22s of imaging is that as the technology has improved, we keep seeing smaller and smaller lesions that are almost certainly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the uncertainty about what they mean leads us to encourage surveillance of these things.
And that's
the
second
findings.
And that's
and
the
then,
second.
And so all of a sudden, the imaging drives more imaging. And
yeah.
So I think all of these things increase imaging. To get back to your particular question, I certainly don't like any system where there's a financial incentive to do more rather than do the right thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, you're talking about loopholes around the Stark Amendments that are trying to limit self-referral. And I think in general, that's not a good thing anywhere in medicine. I think there shouldn't be a linkage between doing more tests and the amount of money you make. But, you know, that's one of the things that needs to be dealt with.
And you really don't address that in your essay, to be fair to you. And so I won't hold you on that question much longer. But I wanted to ask you, though, about what clinicians might be doing. A clinician who's read your essay now, when she goes into her hospital staff meeting next week, how might she act differently, or how might she refer people differently as a result of now a greater awareness of the danger of CT?
I think it's important to acknowledge that imaging tests are just like other areas of healthcare, in that there are benefits and there are also risks and harms. So, you know, my understanding is that any time a new drug is prescribed for a patient, the physician will talk about the likely benefits and the side effects of the medication, and that patients increasingly may make very personal decisions about what they want to do. The same thing goes for lots of healthcare treatments. You know, patients value what they might get or not get. I think imaging needs to be looked at the same way, that there are benefits to imaging. These diagnostic tests can be enormously helpful, but they also come with some risks and some harms and a lot of uncertainty, and that patients need to be involved in that decision-making process. And I think the days where the doctor can say, just go do these tests, they're safe, don't worry about it, I hope will be gone, because you need to worry about it. You don't need to be very concerned about it, and the purpose of my perspective is not in any way to discourage patients from getting tests that they need. But you want to acknowledge that some proportion of tests are just not indicated, and if we had more informed patients and physicians that, in fact, there is some harm, that could be taken into consideration. So if there's a finding that's very unlikely to be significant in terms of morbidity or mortality, that doesn't necessarily need an imaging test. On the other hand, if the diagnosis is almost certain, you also don't need an imaging test. It's not going to treat the patient. So, you know, I could give you my entire personal medical history to tell you which tests I chose to undergo and which ones I didn't undergo. But really, the suspicion of disease has a huge impact on whether a test is necessary. What are we going to learn from this test? Are we kind of in the middle of probabilities where we're kind of maybe yes, maybe no? That's a perfect time to order an imaging test. In the cases where we know for certain it is something, or we know for certain that it's not that, then the imaging test is not going to change our probabilities very much, and it's not going to be that helpful, and then we should avoid the imaging test. And that doesn't mean that all of your patients are going to agree with all of your decisions. It just means you should involve them in the decisions, and that should be realistic considerations of the possible harm from those tests.
Well, that's good advice. I want to thank you for your time with us today, Dr. Smith and Dr. Smith-Beinman.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you.
Well, that's it for this week. My email address is jelia@jwatch.org. or you can leave a voicemail at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all news stories can also be found. The Journal Watch website is jwatch.org, and that includes almost 25 years of summaries of the most clinically useful medical research. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Thanks for listening.